Okay, we're going to go on to the next case, which is 031613, Wilmington versus Stearns. And Mr. Clark, good morning.
May it please the court, my name is Martell Clark, and I'm here on behalf of Petitioner Appellate Patrick Wilmington. Mr. Wilmington was convicted in a closely contested trial of aggravated battery with a firearm. He has exhausted his state remedies and now appeals the denial of his petition for writ of habeas corpus. Mr. Wilmington should receive habeas relief because he was denied a fair trial due to prosecutorial misconduct in violation of the U.S. Constitution and federal law. Moreover, the Illinois Appellate Court's adjudication of his claim was contrary to and an unreasonable application of clearly established federal law, primarily outlined in Darden v. Wainwright and U.S. v. Young. The Illinois Appellate Court unreasonably found that the comments were proper, and then it unreasonably applied the prejudice prong of the Darden analysis to one of the comments. To the extent that it didn't apply Darden, it was contrary to established federal law.
Can you keep your voice up, please?
Sure.
Hard to do, but...
Darden gives us a five-factor test to determine whether improper comments deny a defendant of a fair trial. The appellate court said that any error was cured because the trial court sustained the objection. The Darden factor is not whether the trial court sustained the objection, but whether it instructed the jury to disregard the comment. It also said that the trial court sustained the objection. Well, the trial court did not sustain the objection, as you can see from the record at A053. The court also ignored the many other improper comments that denied Mr. Wilmington a fair trial. They addressed some of the most egregious comments. The prosecutor vouched for the credibility of the two key identification witnesses in this case. Ms. Williams and Ms. Folks both had their testimony contradicted by statements they had previously made to the police. And the prosecutor's response to this was to bolster their testimony by injecting his own personal experience. He caused the jury to believe that their testimony was consistent with what, quote, happens in these cases all the time, end quote. This is the essence of improper vouching. Another instance was when the prosecutor repeatedly suggested that Mr. Wilmington asked his father to cover for him.
Let me make sure that I understand something. My understanding was that Wilmington's counsel objected to only one of the prosecutor's remarks that he challenges in his section 2254. Am I incorrect?
That is correct.
That is correct.
He objected to the comment where the prosecutor suggested that Mr. Wilmington had been impeached a gazillion times.
So we've got a plain error standard going here.
Except that on collateral review, the plain error doesn't apply. I know I argue plain error in my brief, however, that's incorrect, I believe. The prosecutor in this case actually misstated the defendant's testimony. He said that Mr. Wilmington testified, "When I said my house, I meant my apartment."
Let me explain some. I think I ought to. Plain error applies to cases on direct appeal, not to a federal habeas petition that challenges a state conviction. In fact, the burden of justifying habeas relief is even greater than the showing that's required to establish plain error on direct appeal, because that really is because of the deference that we must afford the state court. But go ahead with the rest of your argument.
Okay. Well, we believe that we satisfy even the plain error standard because we believe that the outcome of the trial would have been different in this case. We believe that all five Darden factors weigh in favor of Mr. Wilmington. These comments were serious and were directed towards core fundamental safeguards, such as the presumption of innocence and the right to be tried based upon evidence before the jury. The defense counsel did not invite these improper comments. The trial court did not instruct the jury to disregard the statements. The defense counsel did not have the opportunity to respond because many of the comments were made in the prosecutor's rebuttal. And we believe the weight of the evidence factor weighs in favor of Mr. Wilmington.
I agree with you that this was not a perfect case here, and that some of the prosecutor's comments, which, of course, you know, perfect cases, we don't have to have a perfect case. We know that. Many of the prosecutor's comments were potentially troublesome. But we have to look at the comments in context. And it appears, when we look at it in context, that quite a number of the arguments were based on evidence that was before the jury, such as the witness's demeanor or the consistency of a witness's account, and not on the prosecutor's personal view of the witness. And of course, that type of argument is permissible.
I agree that some of the comments are more egregious than others, especially in the context in which they occur. However, some of the comments are clearly egregious, such as when the prosecutor burden shifted. He said, now Patrick Wilmington, to get the benefit of doubt, I'm all for that, but there has to be reasonable doubt before that benefit could or should be bestowed. This is typical burden shifting. And we believe the weight of the evidence factor weighs in favor of Mr. Wilmington, because we think this was a close case, because the prosecution's case relied upon two key identification witnesses, and both of them had their testimony contradicted. Officer Sullivan testified at trial. He was the first officer responding to the scene. He said he asked both of them if they knew who shot him several times, and they said they did not. This is corroborated by the police reports. Other witnesses, including Mr. Wilmington himself, testified on his behalf. Trevon Lewis, one of the people who was being shot at on the porch, testified that he did not see Mr. Wilmington shoot a gun. He did not see Mr. Wilmington with a gun, and he had every reason to identify the shoot suspect because he was one of the people being shot at. And in this closely contested trial, we believe the cumulative effect of these many improper comments has the effect of denying Mr. Wilmington a fair trial. And I would like to reserve the rest of my time.
Thank you very much, Mr. Clark.
Thank you.
Morning, Mr. Glick.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Michael Glick, and I'm an assistant attorney general here on behalf of Respondent Appellee. In United States versus Young, the Supreme Court stated that the line separating acceptable from impermissible advocacy is not easily drawn. Rather, there's often a gray zone. Similarly, this court has held, within the context of analyzing cases under 2254, that where the constitutional question is a matter of degree rather than concrete entitlement, a reasonable decision by the state court must be honored. Here, the question presented, which is whether petitioner was deprived of a fair trial under the Fifth and Fourteenth Amendments based on prosecutorial misconduct, is the type of matter of degree spoken of in these cases. And accordingly, as long as the state court's decision is one of several equally plausible alternatives, it must be respected here, and habeas relief should be denied. This is particularly so in this case. As my opponent pointed out, the appropriate analysis is Darden, which both the state court and the district court appropriately recognized in articulating the standard, even if they didn't specifically identify it. In light of the fact that Darden's most significant factor is the weight of the evidence against petitioner, and in light of the significant inculpatory evidence, as well as the significant uncontested facts, this case does not warrant relief. there were two witnesses, two eyewitnesses who identified petitioner as the shooter, both who had known petitioner in the past. The same witnesses, the victim and Denisha Fox, identified petitioner from a photo array. They, in addition, petitioner who indicated that
the significance, they couldn't identify him originally, though?
The significance, I believe, is explained by the record as Officer Sullivan testified. Initially, the girls didn't believe that the victim had been shot very severely, but in a short period of time, she started sweating and spitting up blood. It was clear she was in shock. Her friend, he described multiple times as being hysterical. So it was clear that while they didn't identify the petitioner immediately, that was explained by the record. In addition, there's another reference in the record that might explain why these particular individuals didn't identify the petitioner. There's some reference to the petitioner being a member of a gang, and it may be that they might have feared fallout. We don't know specifically.
It might have been what?
They might have feared some sort of fallout, some sort of repercussion from identifying him. Initially, they believed that the victim was not seriously harmed. She thought she had just been grazed by the bullet. When the officer examined her, he noted that, in fact, she had an entry wound, and as the record shows, she was hospitalized for 9 days and endured two surgeries following the shooting. What's most significant is the petitioner's own actions here. He attempted to fabricate an alibi, even though he'd not yet been charged or approached by police, by calling his ex-girlfriend, with whom he had been walking shortly before this incident, and asking her to state that he'd been with her the entire evening. And she said she wasn't going to do that. She wasn't going to lie. He also attempted to fabricate an alibi later on, as is borne out by his father's testimony and the testimony of Montoya Child, both of whom confirmed that petitioner spent the night of June 14th or the early morning of the 15th at his own apartment, not at his parents' house. And that's significant because the bullets, which were consistent with the 25 caliber full metal Winchester brand bullet that was removed from the victim, were found in his apartment on a TV stand behind, or on a dresser behind a TV in his bedroom. His own testimony corroborates these particular bits, and also he contacted the victim a month before she testified here and tried to intimidate her to indicate that she didn't know who shot her. The inculpatory evidence that I've just set forth is also bolstered by petitioner's own testimony, which puts him at the scene of the crime at the relevant time. He testified that he was walking with his girlfriend Monica Rogers and her dog around 10 p.m. that night. He said that they were arguing loudly as they walked up 14th and a half Street. He testified that they met up with, or they noticed a group of boys on the porch at 14th and a half and 15th Avenue, and that an exchange occurred between the two groups. He indicated that he said, "I'll be back," although he indicated it was directed towards his girlfriend Rogers and not the group of boys. He testified that he went back to Monica Rogers' house alone on 19th Street, and that once he arrived there, he called Rogers. That's where he tried to induce her to give an alibi for him. He also indicated that he allowed Reggie Campbell to drive his own car back to Rock Island from Davenport, Iowa, and he stayed behind at his apartment. He testified that he had Montoya Childs pick him up at his apartment. It was stipulated that Denisha Fox didn't have a problem identifying him from a photo array, and he also testified that he spoke to the victim by telephone, and there was corroborative evidence of that as well. The jail records show that a 13-minute phone call was initiated by the day room in the county jail where petitioner had access. So in light of this particular evidence, I think it's also important to point out that my opponent has misstated the testimony of Branford Barrage, and I direct you to item 42, which is the state court transcript at pages 482, 487, and 488, where Barrage clearly indicates that he didn't see a gunman. All he heard was the shooting, and that he heard shots, but he's walking down the street drinking a pop and eating chips, and he wasn't paying attention. And he didn't see the face of the individual he saw in the alley that he believed might have been the gunman, but he clearly said he didn't see the gunman. So petitioner overstates the import of Barrage's testimony. The vouching that occurred here, I think, as the court pointed out earlier, was not impermissible. It was based upon the evidence that was presented. The impermissible burden shifting, I would note that the comment that was referred to earlier, which was the benefit of doubt comment, which is that A49 in petitioner's appendix was waived. It was not raised before the district court. Moreover, to the extent that this court does decide to review the merits of that particular claim, it's distinguished by cases where the court has found impermissible comment because it was not repeated, it was not endorsed by the trial court. In fact, the trial court properly instructed the jury at record pages 637 and 38 that closing or the defendant was presumed innocent and that the presumption remained with him throughout the trial unless and could not be overcome unless he was proven guilty beyond a reasonable doubt.
Let me just make sure that I've got something right. Barash testified that he knew Wilmington from the neighborhood, right?
He said that what he specifically testified was he didn't know him well. He knew him from playing basketball.
And that he was that he saw the shooter get into a car which was not Wilmington.
What he testified to was he was walking some distance from where the shooting occurred. He did not see the shooting.
Right.
He saw somebody dressed in black. The assumption is that he presumed it was the shooter jump into a car. Somebody in black with something shiny in his hand at about the time that the shooting occurred. Now, remember that the testimony here was
but
that everybody was scattering after the shot.
But the car was not Wilmington.
Right, and that was unusual because he said he didn't know Wilmington well, but somehow he knew that the car wasn't Wilmington.
Okay, all right.
That's true. And I would point out, I know Your Honor mentioned earlier that there was only one comment that was objected to at trial, and that was the gazillions. But because the state court's assessment here seemed to embrace the merits rather than clearly rely on defaults, we based our argument below on the merits as well. And just to point out, plain error, again, has no application here because we're not on direct appeal. That's true of many of the cases cited by petitioner, which are not Supreme Court cases, and also fall prey to the fact that they are direct appeal cases employing a plain error analysis. And harmless error is appropriate here. So should the court find that these errors were improper and do amount to constitutional violations, we assert, based upon the weight of the evidence, that they're harmless. Thank
you. I'd like to ask a question about there were some bullets found in Wilmington's apartment. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And their only connection is they were the same caliber, I guess, as the bullet.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Yeah. Weren't
was that the same type of bullet, too?
The same type of bullet. They were 25 caliber full metal jacket Winchester brand bullets, which the forensic expert testified were not common, contrary to what petitioner says. He said, or I think he used the term popular, he just said there were multiple manufacturers of such bullets, but not that they were common. But that's true. He couldn't say that they were
shell casings at the scene or anything.
They did not. There were a number of...
Found a bullet in the victim.
Correct. There were a number of people, bystanders on the scene. It was dark. They weren't able to recover any shell casings. They attempted to go back the next morning and couldn't find any then either. Thank you.
Mr. Clark. Thank you. Mr. Clark, 2 minutes.
First, while there is some range of permissibility in improper comments, there is no gray zone on injecting personal experience, such as the instance when the prosecutor said what happens in these cases all the time. There's also no gray zone on misstating the burden of proof or the presumption of innocence. And we would say that this argument was not waived because it was, in fact, raised in the district court, before the district court. Mr. Wilmington argued that the prosecutor made comments that distort, that undermined the presumption of innocence in his district court brief. To address the evidence points, there was no evidence of gang membership. This was a conversation between the attorneys before the trial began, where one of the attorneys asked whether there was a gang issue. The defendant in this case did speak to the victim And even, but even the victim testified that he did not ask her to lie for him. This is in the record. And there was substantial exculpatory evidence. Like we said, Officer Sullivan testified on his behalf, testifying that neither of the identification witnesses had any, did not know who what the shooter was. Crapper Barrage testified that he saw one man with a shiny object in his hand jump into the back seat of a brown Chevy, and Mr. Wilmington has a blue car. That's how we know that it wasn't Wilmington's car. Trevon Lewis, one of the people on the porch who was being shot at, testified that he didn't see Mr. Wilmington with a gun or shoot anyone. And we cited several Supreme Court cases, including Darden, Young, and Donnelly, and Estelle, and Taylor versus Kentucky. Actually, we didn't cite Donnelly. I'm sorry. The state cited Donnelly. But in conclusion, we respectfully request that this court grant the habeas petition or, in the alternative, remand to the district court for further proceedings.
Thank you very much, Mr. Clark. Now, Mr. Clark, you were appointed, weren't you?
Yes, we were.
Well, you have the thanks of the court for your vigorous representation of Mr. Wilmington, and thanks to your law firm. And thanks also to the Attorney General's office for a well-briefed and well-argued case. The court is very appreciative. Thank you.